Well, here we are, listeners, back in New York, and for our Fashion Law dinner party finale, about to go behind the scenes of the Thom Browne archive as part of the last part of our conversations about archival authenticity. I'm delighted to speak to Tiani Graham about the impact she's having as an American archivist in-house at an American luxury brand, especially as Thom Browne, the brand, celebrates its 20th anniversary. Did you think an archive was a dusty old room, especially at the beginning of these conversations? Think again. As we'll see, especially in this conversation, Thom Browne's archive is at the heart of the design team's process and also, from a fashion lawyer standpoint, at the heart of the inception of trademarks, too. Hi, Tiani. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is so exciting, and I'm so looking forward to speaking to you about your work at Thom Browne.
Thank you so much for having me, Felicia. I'm excited to speak about it.
So I know that you're the principal archivist at Thom Browne, but you're also, of course, a professional archivist and a fashion historian, and you also curate. So I guess to start us out, could you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you become a fashion archivist, and how did you move in-house to a fashion brand like Thom Browne?
Sure. I always tell people I went the most like untraditional route, but I always knew that I wanted to work in fashion. Literally since middle school, I knew that I wanted to work in fashion. The capacities changed like throughout the years as I like became more exposed and just started trying different things out. Like at first, I wanted to be a fashion illustrator. I wanted to follow in the footsteps of Antonio Lopez. And then CAD came into play. So that kind of made the traditional sense of fashion illustration obsolete as a career, like as a profitable career. And coming from where I come from, like fashion was never really seen as like a serious industry, like something that you could really like make a living at. So I was like, okay, I already know my parents are not going to go for me going to college for something that is not promised to be here tomorrow. So then I wanted to be a fashion journalist, but then that blogging began to take over and the traditional literature that we read as far as literature in scholarly journals and magazines and stuff, like that landscape changed. So it was just like, I don't see the long-term profitability of that. So I think I should shift again. My high school also have fashion marketing courses. So I took that as well. And that's how I began to learn the business of fashion. So I decided like at the very least, like I could be a buyer. But with the coursework and doing internships, I realized like, not really my speed. Being behind a desk, doing a lot of math all day, every day. And the hours were very structured as well. Yeah, I realized like, because I'm a creative person as well. So for me to like have long-term fulfillment, I knew that I needed to be able to like utilize my creative side as well. So my LIM College, my alma mater, they had fashion history courses. I've always been a history buff. So I just continued to take every fashion history course I could. And the professor that I had, Amanda Halle, rest in peace, she passed away 2 years ago. And she's the one who truly inspired me to go down this path. Like, she loved fashion history. Like, she lived and breathed it. She had her own YouTube channel that she had a lot of traction with. She wrote books, and she was from London. She used to be a tour guide around London. She went to school for history. It was like very inspiring, and she just exuded so much joy when she taught us, and I wanted to have that same passion in my career. So I knew, like, I never knew how to get there, but I decided, like, I'm going to start with the fashion history courses. And then for one of my research classes, the school's archivist gave us like a crash course on researching through databases. And then that's when I was like, if I could apply fashion history and like this research, this level of research, like using primary resources, like the real deal, and have access to like museums and stuff like that, I would really like feel whole. So, I reached out. I saw that my school was hiring a library assistant, but I knew I wanted to work in the archives specifically. So I don't know. I just went out on a limb one day. Like, I really just was so focused. I knocked on the library director's door and I was like, I know you're looking for a library assistant, but I'm actually interested in working in the archive. How would I go about doing that? What does that look like? They had never had an archives assistant, so he was just like, you can send me a resume and I'll forward it to the archivist and then we can go from there. The next week I had an interview with the archivist and then I became the first archives assistant of LEM College. So that's how I got my foot in the door with archives. And LAM College is a fashion school that specializes in the business of fashion. So the collection that I'm working with are a culmination of everything that I'm interested in. From there, I got my internship, my capstone. Was it my capstone? It was like my senior internship at the Costume Institute at the Met, the Costume Institute Library to be specific, working with Julie Lee. That was literally like the most amazing experience in my life to this day. Every day felt like a dream, just walking into the Met every single day and the access that I had, like being behind the scenes. And I was there the same time as the Heavenly Bodies exhibition. So I saw like when they were setting up and installing a lot of pieces, I was there on the front lines hearing like certain complications and certain hurdles that they had to go through. I was actually the other day, you know how they have like those installation, like the gallery view of the exhibition and Andrew. For the Met, they have Andrew doing voiceover talking about the exhibition and the gallery space. I was able to be in that video, which lives on the Met's YouTube page forever. And it was just like I was there, and we filmed that like 11 o'clock at night on a Thursday, and this was before it was open to the public and before the Met Gala. So it was just like experiences like that, and being able to like be so hands-on. My supervisor Julie and then also Celia Hart, amazing, amazing archivists and librarians. They like really invested themselves in my professional development. They made sure that I needed to know everything and beyond the standard practice. And yeah, everything that they taught me, I've taken with me along my entire career journey. Like, I've not forgotten anything that they've told me.
You described your first archival job. You chose, what stays and what goes. And that's a huge part of archiving that people probably don't appreciate. I mean, not everything stays in the archive. Some things have to go. And so that also helps to craft, the narrative that the archive tells you afterwards. Some pieces might not just be there, but also observing. I mean, when you mentioned being with Andrew Bolton at the Met and just being there and being able to watch, but also being given then in other circumstances hands-on responsibilities and roles, and also, of course, the real importance, I think, for anyone who's listening too, the importance of asking for a role. I think so many people just think, oh, I won't even ask. But often, if you ask, the opportunity presents itself. And of course, being equipped with the knowledge of business, which is so important, even as you're archiving in fashion. So, how do you use all these, you know, really great skills and knowledge and expertise that you have in your day-to-day work at Thom Browne. And maybe as part of that, you can give us some insight into how the archive was founded and also what it's taken for you to organize it, if I may, because I know that it's been a journey.
Oh yeah. On a day-to-day, to go back to the beginning of what you said, on a day-to-day, it really depends on priority. And that shifts like literally every single day for me. I could plan my entire week out, but if I get a request directly from Thom or a request directly from Andrew at the Met, like whatever I'm doing, like stops for them. And I'll reassess after, but that happens often. And it's also, aside from them, the next step would be like, what would drive the business the most? Like, I've been working with the marketing team more frequently. I work with design often as well, because they'll pull pieces from the archive, as a source of inspiration or reference as far as like silhouette or stitching or fabric or color or beading or literally anything. So it will be, and a lot of time we're under like a huge time crunch. Time is like of the essence when it comes to an American fashion brand specifically. So in the beginning, it was like, you know, suits, skirts, like things progressively got introduced, new features, new distinct characteristics, and you see the evolution of different codes and different techniques that we use specific to us. Like, for example, the Hector logo of the dog, Thom and Andrew's dog, you see more of that, and you see how iconic of a symbol it becomes. And then in addition to all of the other symbols that are used as well, that speaks to Thom's American upbringing with sailboats and tennis, sports in general. Thom was an athlete growing up, an athlete swimmer at that. He still runs every day. So just like the inspiration behind the brand is always prominent in the collection. There's always that visual representation. And with each collection, they build off of the last. And as well as applying the different trends of the industry at the time. But I think we do such a good job of taking what we've already done and reinterpreting and reworking. And that's why I love when our design team pulls from the archive, especially like when I know that they're developing the next collection. I'm like, okay, what are they going to do with this? What is this going to look like? And then when I see it, I'm like, oh, that's why you pulled that. But like time is of the essence. So it's also like, what has the most urgency? So that's what I also plan my day to day by. Urgency, Thom or Andrew, they hold precedence over everyone. And then also just like, what would bring in the most money for us? What is the better look? Especially if we're working with like a celebrity and we need to dress Beyonce for her movie premiere and they need the reference for her custom dress, I have to be able to pull it. I need to know where it is in the first place. So things like that. I am still trying to figure out how the archive was founded. There's still a lot of mysteries that I'm trying to solve. So I was glad when you asked that, because now that's like pushed up to my priority level as far as like investigation and research. And that would be like a number one question when I'm doing like my oral history project that I want to start later on. So speaking to like the OGs who were there from like the early years of the company, because there are a lot of gaps in our earlier collections. They might not have thought to save it. They might not have thought to archive it yet at that point. And people don't realize early in a designer's career, they do not make money for a long time. So they're trying to sell as much as they can. Like whoever wants it's yours for the right price. So that's a lot of designers' mentalities in general. But then I think the idea comes when they're a little bit more established in their career and people want to look back. They might have seen an earlier design that they want to reinterpret for themselves or something like that. So I think that might have influenced the Thom Browne archive, but I don't know for sure. But that is something that I'm going to be actively like figuring out because it's a very important question.
Yeah, and we also mentioned, the importance of celebrities and early clients, which,
Yes.
is so important often because I think, we see these celebrities, especially celebrities wearing Thom Browne, I mean, because it is so extravagant and, really pushes fashion forward. But often you see celebrities on the red carpet and you don't realize that they actually might keep a dress or, create kind of their own mini archive, as it were. So have you, found yourself interacting with, I mean, I know you mentioned Beyonce, but other celebrities who might have a Thom Browne outfit that you're interested in seeing or that the design team is interested in seeing, or even that, should be in one of Andrew's exhibitions at the Met?
Yes, everyone always want to know where is Cardi B's Met Gala dress. We don't have it. She does. That is one piece that I would love to like just have my hands on. We still have feathers in the archive. Like I still see remnants of it. So that would be amazing. And it's a huge dress. So I would just love to see like what condition it's in and how like her archival team, if she has one, has been like maintaining it over the years. But yeah, that is like one of the things. I know that it's like a case by case basis as well, as far as like who gets to keep what. But I would love like just from an archivist and historian standpoint, like maybe we have a duplicate. And who holds it is up to them. Like, there has to be an agreement of some sort. But I think that at least, like, if the celebrity owns it, like, if we decide to give it to them, we should have, like, access to it if we need to, at the very least. Like, and again, case by case, depending on what it is. So let's say if Andrew wants to pull it for one of the exhibitions for the Costume Institute, maybe we are the ones to facilitate the logistics and the loan agreements and things like that. So they can have their unlimited access to it, but if we need it for something major, somehow we make an agreement for that.
Yes. So, listen, all those fashion lawyers out there listening, seems like you have at least one archivist who's asking for a draft type of template agreement
Yes.
with certain categories and clauses to facilitate access. That's great because you mentioned duplicate and, often kind of access, but also that means, the Thom Browne universe seeing the dress again, and you as the archivist taking stock of its state of preservation, as it were. It brings up the concept of authenticity, and this episode is thinking a lot about archival authenticity and what that means. How do you think as an archivist about authenticity, and how do you think of authenticity in the Thom Browne universe?
So authenticity, I would say is like derived from authorization. It can't be like in our case, it can't be a true Tom Brown piece if it doesn't have one or two of our main comp actually three, because we have, for example, the four bar, that's not on everything, but as far as like knits and jerseys and casual wear, like that is one of the main identifiers. The red, white, and blue grosgrain, the paper tag that we have, it's not always like, for example, it's not on this cardigan that I'm wearing, but this is an official Thom Browne cardigan.
And you do
But
have the red, white, and blue too on the window.
yes, and it'll always be right here what this is called, the placket, and then on the sleeves as well. It will always be in these two places. Oh, and also at the side. So things like that. And then even down to the grosgrain, there are specific dimensions that they have. There's a specific red, there's a specific white, there's a specific navy. So it comes down to like very minute details. And Tom is still very involved in the authorization of designs. So essentially, if it didn't go through him, it's not official.
So you just basically outlined too, what lawyers to look for when they're comparing designs, or when, they're asked by their client to go after a counterfeit. I mean, you as the in-house archivist play a huge role in identifying what is actually a real Thom Browne product. So,
Yes.
I can imagine that your role is also extremely important in broader, let's say, conversations about authenticity that are happening in different departments too, in-house. And that brings me to today and Thom Browne's 20th anniversary. Could you tell me a little bit about like what's happening in the archive for the 20th anniversary? What have you done? What's maybe on the horizon, or what are you looking forward to?
Ooh, the archive was heavily, heavily, heavily involved in the 20th anniversary celebration. And in the beginning, starting with the book itself, which is the visual representation of our 20th anniversary, I pulled all of the looks that were photographed. I also provided the descriptions of each look, and then worked with design to just make sure like all the details were accurate and that but also descriptive enough for the average person to understand, because some of our pieces are so complex, you need an accurate description, because you also have to think of accessibility. Everyone isn't visually capable of seeing what is displayed. So if you have an accurate description, it kind of backs it up. So I helped with the descriptions as well. I spent up many, many nights working on that. And then also I was on set for the shoot of the book, just making sure everything stayed organized, all of the accessories and went to their assigned looks, and then also making sure that things were styled the way that they were supposed to be, the way that they were worn on the runway. And I also got to go to London to shoot the second half of our book, and that was amazing. So once the book was done, Tom went on a book tour in London, Shanghai, Seoul, Tokyo, New York, Milan. He went to Milan as well. So he did book signings, and then at each retail location of those stops, the archive provided archival looks to just that represented like the feel of each location, And that was also like all of the looks that were featured in the stores were also featured in the book. And I had the idea in the past they had wrapped the mannequins in this red, white, and blue grosgrain. So I thought it would be like a great representation and to have all of the mannequins uniform wrapped in the red, white, and blue grosgrain. So it's just like another nod to the visual history of the company. So that was great. And I was so happy to be involved in such a large capacity. Because when you think of a fashion brand, like a fashion archive, let's say in I think like in a European brand, I don't know if I would have been able to be so hands-on in every single process because they have such developed teams and roles. So everyone kind of like stays in their lane. And I've played many different roles and worn many different hats.
Yeah, you know, maybe that's one of the beauties of an American luxury brand like what you work for at Thom Browne. I mean, having a brand that is so, I mean, of course, 20 years, but still relatively nascent, and, you know, at an early stage, and thinking about archiving in a very dynamic way, very much related to design, you know, product development, merchandising, right? Is a real opportunity for there to be more dialogue between the archive and what's on the market. You know, you're not necessarily in a dusty archive on your own. You're as part of a dynamic team and you really represent the brand.
Yes, very much so. I literally collaborate with almost every department. And I love how now, with my business background, like throwing out ideas, to utilize the archive in order to like drive KPIs and support the collections that are recently released and like show the connection of prior collections. So some of my favorite moments, I would say one is dressing Amy Fine Collins for the Met Gala. And the milliner Stephen Jones had actually accompanied her to the gala, and I wasn't expecting that. I dressed her at her home, and most of the Met Gala guests meet at like the Carlyle or one of the hotels, but she lives right in the city, so it was just easier to dress her at her home. And Stephen Jones was there, and he's like the sweetest person ever. And he designs like almost all of our runway hats and headwear. So especially as like a fashion historian, like meeting him was just like you are the milliner. So and to have seen his name on the labels of our hats and to finally meet him, it was a full circle moment. I would also say at our last New York runway show, I got to meet Queen Latifah,
A
childhood
legend, a legend.
legend. Yes, childhood hero. My mother loves her, like my parents, like they're from the same era. So it was like amazing. It was an honor to meet her. And then I also got to meet Teyana Taylor. And she had expressed to me that she would love to sit at our Met Gala table, and then shortly after, she got to sit at our table.
Well, there, I mean, there again, that for me just goes to show, you know, the role you have as an archivist, right? I mean, seriously, like if more people knew, you could facilitate the invite to the Met Gala. I'm sure they'd be very excited to come to what they first consider to be a dusty archive.
Right. Being in this profession, sometimes we forget what people don't know. Like having so much knowledge, you become unaware of what people don't know. But as an archivist, like we have to always have like an objective point of view. So when I'm describing something to someone, or if I'm ex like, I always explain it as if it's their first introduction, but you're not in a condescending way, you know? It's just like, this is what this is. And then you can draw conclusions and make connections from what's provided.
Yeah, completely. I know exactly what you mean. And that also is really connected to this idea of authenticity, because who says what it is first, and how you shape that notion also affects how people perceive it, and how then that object is translated through time, or how the design is translated through time. So I think that's really important what you highlight, because explaining things and not taking anything for granted can really support, the notion of authenticity that you're trying to communicate. Is there anything you particularly want, people, especially lawyers, to know about the work you do? I mean, I think there are a lot of takeaways here about your wide-ranging role at the brand, how important an archive is for authenticity, but also for perhaps in practice, even for things like IP infringement. But is there anything that you particularly want people to take away when they think of, Tiani Graham at Thom Browne Archivist?
My goal is to have the Thom Browne Archive at a museum level, at the same level as the Costume Institute, because we work so closely together. Tom and Andrew are partners, so their institutions essentially are partners, and the archives should reflect that as well. And I have the rare opportunity of being in, have been being in both spaces. But I still also work very closely with the Met, so I think like having that parallel of standards sets us apart, and I am happy to implement it. And it to me, I really want to highlight how well-rounded our archive is, because I don't think I stated, but our archive consists of all of our runway collections, Tom's actual personal collection of like his suits, his shoes, even some of his art, special collections, so custom work that we've done, most of the Met Gala looks, any like any custom, for the most part, the archive has our furs. We don't produce fur anymore, but any fur that we have in the past, we have archived it. So things like that. And then not only do we have ready to wear, we do couture now as well. So I'll be getting the couture collection, which will have its own needs, just space wise, just
I
storage
was going to say,
wise.
to compare it to the Cardi B dress. Hello, storage. You're going to need a lot.
Exactly right. And one of my main goals has been consolidating space within the archive. So when I came in, we had an off-site space and then a larger off an on-site space at our office, and then a larger off-site space that we couldn't access. When I came in, I restructured the on-site archive space, added more shelving, and just reorganized the way that we store things and what gets stored in there. And then we acquired another off-site space not too far from us, and I use that as like a processing plant. That's where we when we first spoke, that's where I was with all the garment bags. And then I helped design the shelving and the racking systems within the unit. So that was like one of my first really big accomplishments, because I knew that would like increase our efficiency like tenfold, which it has. So yeah, even that, I've done so much, but I plan to do so much more.
I can't wait to see the work that Tiani continues to do at Thom Browne. and to see how fashion brands continue to leverage their archives as part of their design processes, and by extension, as part of their IP rights, especially trademark rights. As I hope you've gathered from these conversations, archival authenticity, the notion of authenticity that comes from the stories an archive tells, the way an archive is managed or used, and the way an archive's evidence is read into legal notions like distinctiveness and trademark law, to link authenticity to a brand's reputation, goodwill, and even more information communicated to consumers through a trademark, is important for fashion brands, and it will continue to be in the future. Another concept that's important to fashion and law, iconic. Have you heard this word recently? It's come up in my conversations with fashion industry stakeholders and in my own legal research as brands seek to register their marks and even market their designs. What makes an iconic product? That's the topic of our next Fashion Law Dinner Party. Join me for that next dinner party when I'll speak to Calvin Klein's residence historian and archivist, and to the founder of the IP Cat, Eleonora Rosati, about the value of iconic in fashion and law.